Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now a call-in on the question, is our country better or worse for the traumatic events of Charlottesville and its aftermath? And what have you been wanting to say publicly about any of it? 212-433-WNYC. The past week has not been just any other week of news events. It may turn out to have been not just a tragic one, but a politically and culturally defining one for the United States. So here was Susan Breaux, Heather Heyer's mom. Was she right when she said this in her heartbreaking eulogy?
They tried to kill my child to shut her up. Well, guess what? You just magnified her.
So listeners, is our country better or worse for the traumatic events of Charlottesville and its aftermath? Are Heather Heyer's better angels and maybe those of more Americans than not magnified for all of what has gone on? 212-433-WNYC. Or are they not? Among other things, it was a week when the country had to confront the reality that there is an emboldened white supremacist movement in our midst since the election. And we had to look Confederate and other racist monuments in the eye for what they are, from Charlottesville to Fifth Avenue across from the Academy of Medicine, and have difficult conversations about them. Like, we got this call on yesterday's show from Janine from Park Slope.
Going to Robert E. Lee, I think it's why I work in activism, to be brutally honest, because things that I've been saying for 20 years, I used to protest apartheid. I would skip school to go down to the South African embassy. My mom doesn't know that, but I would go and protest. And seeing that flag, and it's still Robert E. Lee High School, and the flag is still there.
She went to African-American woman. She went to Robert E. Lee High School in Virginia. And as she says, it inspired her to become an activist. And it's still Robert E. Lee High School. And I guess she was referring to the Confederate flag is still there, Janine from Park Slope. And it was a week when the President of the United States gave an elaborate wink to the surging white nationalist movement and got called out by almost everyone, by the CEOs on his own business councils, by many Republicans in Congress, and by his own military brass. Maybe that's why he had this kind of weird preamble about love and harmony in his Afghanistan war speech last night. He seemed to think the path to ending polarization in this country is through patriotic reverence for the military.
Loyalty to our nation demands loyalty to one another. Love for America requires love for all of its people. When we open our hearts to patriotism, there is no room for prejudice, no place for bigotry, and no tolerance for hate.
Trump from last night, reverence for patriotism, the precursor of nationalism, is the only path he found to universal love, not Jesus or humanitarian principles, but maybe that's another show. And I get that there's about a quarter of the country who thinks he was overinterpreted by the rest of us, that he denounced hate and violence on all sides from the start. And yes, there was violence by at least two sides. There was in Charlottesville, and that should have been enough. And we'll talk about the leftist violent side later in the show. But seeing him as overinterpreted is a minority view for good reason. The full sequence of events and the context of how he ran his campaign, even courting white resentment from the start, making explicitly bigoted statements as political strategy, pretending not to know who David Duke was last year when Duke endorsed him, even though Trump had explicitly denounced David Duke in the past. All of it led up to the understanding of last week and Trump in context. And you know what one of the tips was to me? This didn't get a lot of press, I don't think, but in that Fire and Fury news conference he gave last Tuesday, well, you know how Trump tends not to wait for all the facts on things? How he jumps based on a little shred of evidence to say Obama wasn't born in this country, or there were millions of fraudulent votes for Hillary Clinton, whatever example you like best, for whatever suits his political agenda. Well, only on white supremacists and Russia does he say he can't come to a conclusion because the facts are in doubt.
I wanted to make sure, unlike most politicians, that what I said was correct. not make a quick statement. The statement I made on Saturday, the first statement, was a fine statement. But you don't make statements that direct unless you know the fact. It takes a little while to get the facts. You still don't know the facts.
On Russia and on white supremacists, but he knows the facts on everything else. But he got caught. He got called out by almost everyone. So listeners, my question is our country better or worse for the traumatic events of Charlottesville and its aftermath? Maybe we're better off for getting more of this out in the open, not just about Trump, about everything. Or maybe we're no better off because, like, the Access Hollywood tape didn't matter. Dissing the Cold Star Khan family for days didn't matter. Judge Curiel, the original blanket Muslim ban proposal, it all just played to the politics of white and male resentment in certain corners of the population. But you tell me, is our country better or worse for the traumatic events of Charlottesville and its aftermath? And what else have you been wanting to say publicly about any of it? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And we'll take your calls right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And just before we take your calls on the question, is our country better or worse for the traumatic events of Charlottesville and its aftermath, I just want to mention two people who gave their lives for this cause, because three people died directly or indirectly as a result of the white supremacist coming out party. We all know the name Heather Heyer now, but I also want to say the names of the other two victims, and they were the state troopers who died in the line of duty in Charlottesville in a helicopter crash as they were in the sky that day to patrol the demonstrations and protect the governor of Virginia's related motorcade. As described by the New York Times, Lieutenant H.J. Cullen was a veteran Virginia State Police trooper who had nearly 20 years of experience flying helicopters and airplanes for the department's aviation unit. And Trooper Burke M.M. Bates paid his way through aviation school last year in hopes of fulfilling his lifelong dream of flying for the state police. So when Governor Terry McAuliffe announced that three people had died pursuant to the violence, it was Heather Heyer, Trooper H.J. Cullen, and Trooper Burke M.M. Bates. And I just wanted to say their names out loud. And ironic, maybe, that three white people died from the white supremacists' adventure. Desmond in Crown Heights, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, Brian, and thank you for taking my call. My point is this, it's that it's not whether it's better or worse, it's just that it's a worldwide alarm to the fact that white supremacy exists and the ubiquity of it. It's been in place in South Africa, in the UK, in Australia, and it's basically becoming the worm turning of the same people who had been colonized through imperialism doing everything that they were supposed to do. They went to school, they worked hard, they worked multiple jobs, they accumulated a modicum of wealth, and now they're rising up. And the biggest wake-up call was when we had a Harvard-educated black president, even though that he was black and white. And this is just the final culmination of things that have been going on all over the world.
Do you think that there is at least a realization on the part of more people that there is a white supremacist movement in this country that's probably bigger than it was before Obama was elected, and a more, what's the word, kind of out loud, therefore, denunciation of them from all corners, kind of helping to make sure that they remain fringe?
They are not going to remain fringe because white males, and say it just like that, are afraid. Cantwell basically spoke on the Vice News documentary. He said that he would use violence immediately. It's not even a question. He had four automatic weapons on his person and a knife. And this has been the credo of white males for centuries.
But don't paint with too broad a brush, right?
Well, Manifest Destiny did what? By any means necessary, you seized whatever it was that a minority, a third world person, or a person who wasn't a white male.
Mm-hmm. Can't argue with that.
When Cantwell spoke, he said, well, the Indians had the country, but we took it from them. They should have fought harder. This has been the case in Asia, Africa, Central and South America, and all through North mm-hmm. America.
European colonialism and American, as you say, manifest destiny, undeniable. Desmond, thank you very much. Sarah in Parsippany, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sarah.
Brian, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm going to kind of agree with your previous caller. It's not better or worse, but, you know, eye-opening. And my husband and I had an incident earlier this week. We have an African nanny, and she went to drop off my son at school. One of the kids made an insensitive racial comment, and the teachers just stood by, which, you know, we decided that that wasn't okay, and we decided to draw the line and pull him out of that school. And I think the broader picture is people in the majority really need to take notice of what's going on and, you know, not stand by idly. It's because people stand by and do nothing that tragic events like Charlottesville happen.
Sarah, thank you very much. Deshaun in Paramus, you're on WNYC. Hi, Deshaun.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think this could have the potential to get worse. I mean, you know, I should preface this with, you know, as an African-American male and as an educator, I feel certain parallels between these statues. And listen, I'm fully supportive. I support my students disagreeing with me as long as they can make cogent points.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm all for that. So this happens to be one opinion of one African-American male out of many. So not everybody's going to agree with me. However, I feel certain parallels between these statues and these monuments and something like, concentration camps for Jews. While these aren't the sites, specific sites of tragedies, they are the sites more broadly in the South where these things occurred. And just from these current events, I have my students asking me, why are these statues here? What are the stories behind them? Ideologies might change in the South where hopefully people come together and they realize that these symbols have a negative connotation. However, once that view becomes prevalent throughout the South, I still would like children to question, what do these statues symbolize? It can't be forgotten. And for me, these kind of need to be like a scarlet letter in the South. And they need to be, to spur conversation. Yes, there are plantations and there are sites where people can choose to visit. And I understand how it's kind of like a double-edged sword because these are monuments that were meant to instill pride in people at one point. However, now they need to be there to make people and children remember why they're there.
And
the
so I guess the one of the questions becomes, be there how and in what context? I think one of the things that a lot of Americans learn through all the coverage of Charlottesville and et cetera is that particular Robert E. Lee statue and a lot of things like that weren't put up just after the Civil War. They were put up in the Jim Crow era, that one in the 1920s, when, there was the white backlash against Reconstruction and all of that. And, which in a way makes it even worse. But that now take them down, is this what you're saying? Take them down as things to be revered, but put them in museums so people can go still see them.
Yeah, I guess there's an emotional side to me that it's almost as if, no, you don't get to get away with that easily. You don't get to just take those down that easily, and now we're just going to forget. Because the reality is people remember now, but generations have a funny way of forgetting as people die off. And this, obviously, I feel very passionately that this can't be forgotten. No, you don't get to take off that scarlet letter that easily. And I think that that idea might be getting a little lost. And listen, I'm excited to hear people that may call up and disagree with me and passionately, but I'm not saying my way is the only way.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to spur a conversation here. Like, I'm proposing this idea. Let's see what people think.
All right.
Let's
see what people think. Deshaun, thank you very much. Sandra in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sandra.
Hi, I'm glad you're talking about this, because after those comments, I became quite depressed. It's just been a malaise hanging over my life since all this occurred. I'm a motorcyclist, and I frequently drive across the country. And I've enjoyed conversations with people in the Midwest who think very different from me. And sometimes it was pretty scary. I went through Arkansas the year before last, and I thought the Confederate flag was a state flag. But now, this year, I plan to go to West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a little frightened. I think I'm going to change that. As a black lesbian female who has very short hair and walks around in motorcycle gear, I don't know if I'll be safe there. And I'm not sure where I'm going to ride, because a lot of this country supports Trump. You know, we live in these cities and we're in a little cocoon, but it's a little scary when it gets a bit more rural. So I'm glad you're talking about this.
So you feel like that there is just more license that people feel to express.
You pass the people have signs on their front lawn, actually, that will just write out why they hate Obama. When I rode a couple of, the last 8 years, and I passed barns, Trump is like the entire side of the barn is Trump.
Maybe in those cases, that's like posting a Confederate flag.
Yeah, but I tell you, I really did. I saw so many Confederate flags that I started to get sort of just numb to it, and people treated me pretty well. But like you said, now there's probably license for people. I don't have to respect her anymore. No need to be friendly.
Sandra, ride safe out there and keep reporting back to us, okay?
Thank you.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Vanessa in Reading, you're on WNYC. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thank you.
I'm just taking you off speakerphone while I was on hold.
Good.
Except the phone doesn't want to work properly for me. I was at the Trump rally in Fairfield, Connecticut last year. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. And there were people there supporting Trump, but we were part of a counter-protest, Love Trump's Hate. And across the street from us, some white supremacists, white nationalists, whatever they want to call them, set up a banner that said, diversity equals white genocide. And my friend and I pointed out to the people going into the Trump rally, those people across the street are on your side, and that by supporting Trump, you are saying it's okay for this. And that I think what happened in Charlottesville, while horrible, it finally brought to light that this isn't just on the underground in the outskirts, because when I called into your show, there was a gentleman who had gone to the Trump rally in support of Trump, and he said, oh, no, I'm sure there weren't white nationalists, and they weren't from the area. But it didn't matter. To me, I think it's just Trump has fomented hate, and that finally people are waking up to this fact. And hopefully the line is drawn in the sand. And also, friends are being driven to activism, and we're supporting, like, the Southern Poverty Law Center and other anti-hate groups.
So in the context of all of that and your experience, from last year that you were describing and your previous call and everything else, what how do you think Charlottesville builds on that narrative? And I want to just dismiss it as a narrative. I mean, these are real concrete things, and things happen, and people died and everything. But how does Charlottesville change the national story? Does it leave us in a different place than we were before 10 days ago?
I think it does, only in the fact that people were willfully ignorant, oblivious, or just naive in that this was going on. And it finally brought it to the national attention. We haven't stopped talking about it. And when you look at the rally in Boston, there were thousands of people coming out to say, this is wrong. We are better than this. And we are stronger and in greater number. And that I think, you know, there were so many of us on the periphery saying, look what's going on. You have to see, and they were not seeing. So It took this tragedy and these hateful men and women showing up to bring it to the national attention.
Thank you very much, Vanessa. Do one more. Vernon on Staten Island. You're on WNYC. Hi, Vernon.
Hi, Brian. How are you doing?
I'm okay, thank you.
I think it's great. I mean, it's not great that people lost their lives. That's a terrible thing. But I think these conflicts have been simmering underground for a really long time. I think the election of Barack Obama and his reelection was a shock to the white supremacist ideology, subconscious system, whatever you'd like to call it. And the fact that Trump, who himself in his family history had engaged in discriminatory practices in terms of rental properties, and had been very outspoken about his tolerance for violence against people protesting against him during his campaign, all of this was bound to come to a head. It's very interesting that he had this kind of very, very tolerant section of his speech in addressing armed services people, because the heads of all the armed services came out immediately and very strongly against his equivocations about white nationalists. So he was speaking to me. When I often think that the scripted, you know, touchy-feely, let's all get along Trump is the fake Trump. The Trump that shoots from the hip and is divisive and is, you know, wants to take transgender people out of the military, that's the real Trump. That's the actual Trump. And I think this has been a long time coming. And we're going to have some difficult days ahead.
Or there is no actual Trump, and he does whatever he needs to do to glorify himself. Not that he doesn't have nationalist instincts. I think he showed that for long enough. But because he sees building that nationalism, building on the racist, nativist, sexist sentiments, all of that in the worst, you know, parts of some people's natures as his path to victory in the election and then success as a president, quote unquote success, that it's his behavior, because he no matter what he thinks in his heart, he succumbs to that temptation time and time again if it's in his interest.
I think he's essentially a hollow man. He's quite happy to hobnob with black celebrities. He's quite happy to be seen with certain people, but I think you're really right about that. I think whatever is convenient at the time, he will go with. But at the same time, he has in his cabinet Jeff Sessions, who is going to be a nightmare in terms of like the problem with sentencing disparities and mass incarceration, the worst possible AG. I was shuddering that he would have Rudy Giuliani, and now, you know, it's like he got who we have an AG that's maybe five times worse. And then Steve Bannon is going to be, I think, much more dangerous in his role as a provocateur.
From the outside, and we will see. Vernon, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. Thanks to all of you who called. A lot of you are tweeting on this question. Is the country better off in some way or only worse off from the tragic and horrifying events of Charlottesville and the aftermath? Keep the conversation going on Twitter @BrianLehrer.